From a secret location in room 100 of 540 Jack Gibbs Boulevard, this is Craft. I'm your host, Doug Dangler.
Astrophysicist and Oberlin College Associate Professor of Physics and Astronomy, Dr. Jillian Scudder, has been writing about space for a general audience since 2013, with her work appearing in publications like Forbes, Quartz, and The Independent. She's written several books, including Astroquizzical, A Beginner's Journey Through the Cosmos, and a book to be released this year. Her most recently published book is 2022's The Milky Way Smells of Rum and Raspberries and Other Amazing Cosmic Facts. Welcome to Craft, Jillian Scudder.
Thank you.
So you mentioned in the prologue to The Milky Way Smells of Rum and Raspberries that you tell your students that you have three interests: space, dinosaurs, and volcanoes. How did space win out for your career?
It's kind of by accident. I think it became the winner, not because I would have been unhappy learning about volcanoes, or I would have been unhappy learning about dinosaurs. I think any of them I could have gone into in a different life, but the stars were accessible in a way that the others were not.
Now, wait a minute. The stars are accessible. You're going to have to uncover that for me, because I think of the stars as super far away, whereas a dinosaur fossil you can pick up and hold in your hand.
But you have to go somewhere special, and you're probably not going to actually touch the dinosaur bones. You're going to maybe get to hold a replica or be near a replica, and you still have to be in a museum. Everyone has a night sky. If you go outside and look up, the stars are there. And you don't need to be anywhere in particular. You'll see more of them if you're in a dark place, but you can see a few no matter where you are. So that's what I mean by accessible.
All right, I could take that. Although, you know, volcanoes can be accessible, although unhealthy.
I would rather my volcanoes not be accessible, if I'm perfectly honest.
Your book title, The Milky Way Smells of Rum and Raspberries, naturally gives rise to two important questions. The first is, how do we know what the Milky Way smells like? And is it a good quality rum?
That's an interesting question and an interesting story about how we know. And really, it's from looking for something else entirely. So scientists have been looking for this question of how uncommon life is for a long time. And one of the ways that we do that is we go looking for complex molecules in space. And so we're really looking for things like amino acids, these building block molecules that we use on Earth for most of our life. But when you go hunting for complex molecules, you're going to find a whole bunch of complex molecules, and not just the ones that you're particularly interested in necessarily. So in this hunt for helpful molecules for life purposes, we found the signatures of ethyl formate, which is the compound that's responsible for the flavor of raspberries and the smell of rum, and just straight ethanol, grain alcohol. So I wouldn't say it's good quality rum. It's also got a whole bunch of stuff in there that kills you. So I would personally not choose to drink it.
I've always thought of space as more or less large amounts of empty space with maybe some dust in it. How much is out there that you could feasibly smell anything? Or is it just the idea that there are molecules floating around, and those are some of the more common molecules?
It is very, very thinly spread out. So your mental perception is pretty good. You just need to mix in, along with dust, a little bit of gas. And then you're pretty much spot on for what most of the galaxy is like. It's pretty empty. So what we're discussing here, this smelling of something, is really the chemicals that we receive on Earth in much higher quantities as the smell of rum or the taste of raspberries are present out there. So if you were to put your nose out in space and have a sniff, you would die, but you would also probably not smell anything because it's so scarce. The gas is not very dense at all. So you would first expire and then second not smell anything on your way out.
Okay. So maybe not smelling the Milky Way is the best way to go.
I recommend smelling many things on Earth, but not the general voidness that is interstellar space.
Right. Okay. Your first chapter in The Milky Way Smells of Rum and Raspberries is titled The Universe is the Dimmest It's Been in Billions of Years. And I'm wondering if that is related to the rise of flat earthers.
No, it is not.
I'm kidding. But tell me about how the universe has dimmed over time. It seems kind of like it's related to the way that the universe is spreading out and not making as many stars.
So it is unrelated to the spreading out of the universe, strictly speaking, but it is related to how things are not forming as many stars as we continue forward in time. So the general premise of how a galaxy functions is you have this pile of gas and dust and stars all mixed together and held together by gravity. And the more gas you have that's around and present and available, the more stars you can make. And when you make stars, sometimes you make really large stars, which live for functionally no time at all and just immediately explode. And then you have that gas returned back to the general environment. You can use that again. But you also make a whole bunch of small stars, and those live for billions of years, tens of billions of years, hundreds of billions of years, depending on how small your star is. And those ones, basically, you take the gas that you took to make that star and it's stuck there. It's being a star now. So gradually, when you're making lots and lots of stars, you use up the available gas that's in a galaxy. And then you can't make as many. And so over time, the galaxies have built up these low-mass stars and other stars. And so they've drained the gas that they need to make those stars. And we're left with a lot more stars and a lot less new stars happening. So all galaxies seem to have gone through that. And so on average, the typical galaxy now is forming many fewer stars than it used to several billion years ago.
And I think you said it's something like on the order of 10 times fewer stars are being made now than when the universe was at its brightest.
Yes, that's about right.
So what is the functional impact of that? Other than the brightness of the galaxy, does it have other impacts on other things in the universe? I'm just curious that if this is something that's simply, oh, that's interesting that there's fewer being formed, or whether it has real implications in terms of what those stars are doing when they form and the possible formation of planets and things like that.
Mm. Okay. Yeah. So we are now thinking that most stars, when they form, also form planets. So if you're interested in forming a lot of planets, then forming a lot of stars is a good way to do that, which means that probably we were forming planets at a much higher rate when the universe was at its brightest than we are now, because it's a part of the process of forming a star. You have leftover bits of gas and dust that don't make it into the star, and then you have that just sort of condenses down, and now you have a planet. So if you're interested in making the most number of planets possible, then yeah, make a lot of stars. So yeah, we will be making fewer planets now than we would have when the universe was at its brightest. So that's certainly an effect. Otherwise, what it does is it changes the color of the galaxy, which isn't very impactful, but it's cool. So when you're forming lots of new stars, you tend to form a lot of blue light out of the hottest and youngest stars that don't live very long. And when you're down to older stars, they tend to be redder. So you can kind of tell what a galaxy's been doing recently just by looking at how blue it is.
That makes sense. So you've got a book full of amazing cosmic facts, as the title says. What is your favorite fact that you either discovered while researching the book or one that you can't resist sharing with other people?
There's two. Are you up for two?
I am up for two.
All right. So my first one that I really just didn't have a good handle on when I started researching and writing this book was the volcanoes on the moon. I knew that there had been volcanoes on the moon, and I had been misled by some early visualizations of what that could have been like. And I was sitting there thinking like, oh, there must have been like open lava fields on the moon somehow. But no, what happened on the moon was actually, it just exploded. It had thousands and thousands of small scale eruptions and explosions. Because when you bring magma to the surface of the moon, there's no atmospheric pressure. There's no pressure of any kind. So any gases that are mixed in with that magma just explode. And so you have basically the shake and soda can problem, but with magma. And so that was fun to learn about. So there's when the Apollo astronauts went to the moon, they were finding tiny little glass beads all over the moon. And that's just because the volcanic eruptions flung tiny bits of molten glass all over the place. So that one was, I think, was particularly fun for me to readjust my own model of what that was and what that looked like.
Right. And this was during the formation of the moon when the gases were seeking a way out, I would assume.
This was actually well after the formation of the moon, but while it still was molten on the interior. And so it was just trying to find a way out. Things were not 100% stable. And usually the easiest way out was through some large crater that had been punched into the surface, just because it fractured the rock and it was a little bit thinner there because it carved out a divot. And so that's part of why the dark patches on the moon, which are volcanic material, are all kind of circular. It's filling in really old impact craters on the moon.
Interesting. As if it's wanting to return to a more perfect sphere shape.
Yes.
Yeah. And what was the second fact?
The second fact was that I knew and have taught that it rains diamonds on Neptune. Mm-hmm. I did not know how we had come to that conclusion. And I certainly did not know that we came to that conclusion by firing high-powered lasers at styrofoam.
Okay.
Which right. is just an amazing experiment. Like so, someone got funding to fire high-powered lasers at styrofoam, and it worked. It did what they were hoping it would do, and now we know that diamonds probably rain out of the atmosphere on Neptune without even having been there.
Like
we swung past it one time, and that's as far as we've gotten towards Neptune.
So that raises a couple of questions.
Yes.
Instead of playing with the cat with a laser pointer, can I have an inexhaustible supply of diamonds with styrene and my laser?
You'd need a much higher powered laser than the standard laser pointer.
Okay.
These are industrial strength.
So I had always thought that diamonds formed under immense pressure and heat. The laser brings the heat, I suppose. Mm-hmm. But how does it... I'm still curious on how it can make diamonds.
So how it can work is so the styrofoam is the non-branded form is called polystyrene. And styrene is a molecule that if you hook it together becomes many and therefore the poly. And it's basically just made out of carbon and hydrogen atoms. You hook it all together, you get the plasticky stuff that we use as packing material. Mm-hmm. If you fire a high-powered laser at it, what it does is heat the surface of the styrofoam where it hit very abruptly and very rapidly. And so the pressure comes from the shock wave of heating and expanding that initial bit of styrofoam. And so then that creates a little shock front in the styrofoam where you have both the pressure and the heat from the laser. And in that little ring of where you've exploded your styrofoam, you can create really, really tiny diamonds.
So what are the size of the diamonds suspected to be on Neptune during a good rainstorm?
A good rainstorm? Well, we don't actually know, but probably bigger than the ones that they found in the lab, because the laser can only be on for nanoseconds at a time. Whereas the pressure in Neptune's atmosphere, and it's got methane, so that's the source of the carbon there, is just that's what the pressure is. The atmosphere just lives like that. Mm-hmm. So you could, in principle, make quite reasonably sized diamonds, like large diamonds. So one of the theories is that, okay, well, if you form a diamond in Neptune's atmosphere and it's going to grow because the methane is around, there's plenty of pressure, there's probably plenty of heat, it's going to sink in the atmosphere because the diamond is now more dense than the surrounding gas. And it's going to fall, but it's falling through a dense gas. And so Neptune is a little bit warmer than we think it should be. But if you use diamond dust or like actual chunky diamonds as functionally sandpaper in the atmosphere, you may be able to heat the atmosphere up from the inside by just shoving diamonds down as rain.
That has given rise, I suspect, to the saying, Neptune is a girl's best friend, something along those lines. Anyway, you have another...
It's much easier to make them at home.
Okay. I will keep my at-home diamond creation business hopes alive from what you're saying. You have another book forthcoming in 2024. Can you tell us a little bit about that, when it's coming out, and what it will be about?
Sure. So it has been a little bit delayed, so it will probably not be coming out this year, but hopefully next year. And it is a graphic guide to the universe. And so what I've done in this book, it's going to be fully illustrated. And what I've done is written a chronology of the universe. So we start at the beginning and we proceed our way through to the present day and then forwards into the future to talk about what should happen in the future. And it was really fun to write because it's not very often you get to start at the beginning and then just go all the way through mm-hmm. the entire universe's history and then onwards into stuff that hasn't happened yet.
Of course, then you get to the depressing end of the heat death.
Yes, right? You do get to the depressing end of the heat death.
Right. And then you sort of sit there and wonder, why am I writing this book? You know, it's all for naught. But obviously that's billions of years from now.
Oh, well past billions. We're into trillions and trillions, trillions of years. And trillions.
Okay, well, that's good because I probably won't be around for it. So
I don't think so.
Yeah, so that's okay. Jillian Scudder, thank you very much for talking to me today. Again, the book is The Milky Way Smells of Rum and Raspberries and Other Amazing Cosmic Facts. And you can meet Dr. Scudder at the Ohioana Book Festival. And more information will be available on craftheshow.com so that you can set up a time to buy the book and meet the astrophysicist and associate professor of physics and astronomy. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
For more information from my guests, visit www.craftheshow.com. This is Doug Dangler. Until next time, be creative.
All those old
they were wonderful
records,
then.
Those old phonograph records, the ones we used to play so long ago.
Record Store Day arrives this Saturday, April 20th, and Music Journey celebrates the day with a special rebroadcast of our conversations with five Columbus record stores. Spoonful, Lost Weekend, Records Per Minute, Used Kids, and Love Light. Hear owners reflect on their love of music and vinyl, what makes their shops unique, the value of RSD, and how they handle the day. That's coming up on Music Journey Saturday afternoon at 3:30 on WCBE, or listen to the podcast with extended features on the five shops. It's available now on Apple, Spotify, and NPR One, or find Music Journeys in our own hub, the podcast experience at WCBE.org and the WCBE app. Thanks to all record stores for everything they do for music lovers.